Good afternoon.
We are delighted to welcome with us West Salem High School students. Would they please stand? Good. Thank you all for coming. You may be seated. Were you able to be here for the conversation with Justice Prosser at lunch?
No.
No. Okay. All right. All right, good. Maybe we can help you right after this conference, right after this oral argument. The students are here with a national award-winning program called Court with Class. It is sponsored by the Supreme Court and the State Bar of Wisconsin. Under this program, students are invited to come and listen to an oral argument. If they come, they've been given briefs of the case we are about to hear and may engage in some activities relating to this case. They come, they listen to oral argument, and most students come in the morning and are able to participate at lunchtime in a discussion with a justice of this court. The discussion involves the procedure of the court, not the substantive issue of the cases. Let me introduce the court to you all. On my far left is Justice Annette Zegra. Seated next to her is Justice Patience Rogensack. To my immediate left is Justice Patrick Crooks. I'm Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice. To my right is Justice Ann Walsh Bradley. And to her right, Justice David Prosser. And on the far right is Justice Lewis Butler. With those introductions made, I'll call our last case for today, 2006 AP 2744 CR and other numbers relating to State versus Alexander Grunke, Nicholas Grunke, and Dustin Radke. Arguing on behalf of the state is Assistant Attorney General William Gansner, and we have Susan Edwards arguing for 10 minutes on behalf of Nicholas Owen Grunke, and Jeffrey Olson arguing for 20 minutes on behalf of Dustin Radke. Is that correct? Mr. Gansner.
May it please the court, good afternoon. I'm Assistant Attorney General William Gansner, representing the petitioner in this case, the state of Wisconsin. The state appealed in this case from a circuit court order refusing the bindover of the defendants on a charge of attempted third-degree sexual assault. The effect of that refusal to bind over was the dismissal of that charge. The state appealed. The Court of Appeals affirmed the circuit court's order, the Grant County Circuit Court's order. The state petition for review, and this court granted the state's petition. A question of statutory interpretation is before the court. The question is the meaning of the handful of words of subsection 7 of Wisconsin's sexual assault law, section 940.225. That section, added in the spring of 1986, which provides: this section applies whether a victim is dead or alive at the time of the sexual contact or sexual intercourse. The parties agree, I believe there has never been a dispute in this case, that the language "this section" applies to section 940.225, the sexual assault law.
And all the subsections and divisions thereof. Is
exactly,
that your point?
Your Honor. Exactly. Exactly. I do not believe there has been any disagreement between the parties. Nor is there, for the purpose of this appeal, any dispute over the facts, since there has been the material facts at this stage, since there has been no trial nor plea in this case, and the case was simply dismissed. The attempted third-degree sexual assault charge was dismissed effectively at the preliminary hearing. The material facts before this court are relatively simple. They were stated, with one exception, in the decision of the Court of Appeals, And they are those facts that were alleged in the complaint and on which testimony was presented at the preliminary hearing. Those facts are quite simple. It is alleged that the three defendants in this case, all of them 20 years old at the time, two twin brothers, the Grunkies, and an acquaintance, Dustin Radke, late in the evening of September 2, 2006, drove to a cemetery in Cassville, Wisconsin, planning to disinter the body of a woman who had been killed in an automobile accident and buried within the previous couple of weeks. The plan was, as the statement of one of the defendants to the police in custody indicated, was that the body, after being disinterred, would be taken to another location where one of the Grunke brothers, Nicholas, intended to have sexual intercourse with the dead woman. The defendants dug down to the burial vault, dug a hole 3.5 feet wide by 3 feet long and almost 2 feet deep, and uncovered the top of the burial vault. They were interrupted, however, in their plans by a couple of events, according to the complaint. They discovered that the vault was very heavy and was difficult to open, and while they had tools available, a crowbar and a pry bar apparently, they found it difficult to do so. And while they were at the scene, a car drove into the cemetery, startled them, and they ran away. They were subsequently apprehended and taken into custody. The one fact that was left out of the Court of Appeals decision is a fact that relates to a question as well that I think is undisputed at this point, given the nature of the plan that was acknowledged by one of the defendants. That is, the plan was to have had that one of the defendants intended, after moving the body to another location, to have sexual intercourse with it. The one fact that was not mentioned in the Court of Appeals decision was that on the way from their starting point to the cemetery in Dodge in Cassville, the three defendants stopped at a Walmart store in the town of Dodgeville and bought a package of condoms. The question in this case is whether or not these facts support, under the law of Wisconsin, a charge of attempted third-degree sexual assault. There was never a challenge in the circuit court to the sufficiency of the factual allegations to sustain a charge of attempt, because it appeared clear from the factual allegations of the complaint and from the testimony at the preliminary hearing that a plan to disinter the body, remove it, and then one of the three defendants to have sexual intercourse with the body was, in fact, the plan. That was the intent. That was the objective of their activity. And that their plan had been set into motion. They were attempting to complete this planned criminal activity when they were startled, interrupted, and terminated their activities at the cemetery.
In some ways, I just can't help but think how horrendous the facts are, as you just stated them. I mean, outrageous. And yet, other than the fact that a corpse was involved, it seems like nothing else is in dispute, and that the legal issue before us today has very little to do with the facts that you just recited.
Well, I think it's important to look at the facts of this case to place this case in context, given the importance.
Hey, let me ask, does it make any difference that they stopped at a drugstore to buy a condom for our legal determination here today?
Well, simply for the purpose of demonstrating that there was no question in this case. The evidence was we don't have a defect in this case as to whether or not there was a plan.
Is pled by the defendant.
There has been the only motions that were put, the defensive matters that were put before the circuit court, were their motions to dismiss on grounds that the statute didn't cover the alleged activity. But I think it's important to determine whether the statute covers the alleged activity.
What were they bound over?
Know what the alleged activity was.
What were they bound over for?
They wound up being bound over for judge. The judge determined that the defendants could be, they could not be bound over on a charge of third-degree sexual assault.
All right.
And he determined...
What's the penalty for that, third-degree sexual assault?
The charge that was before the court, well, it's half of the charge of third-degree sexual assault.
What is it?
Yeah, and I believe it's 20 years.
Okay. What charge were they bound?
Ten years.
What were they bound over on?
The judge bound over on a charge of, I believe, and my opponents here can correct me if I'm wrong, because we concentrated on what was bound over. The charge they were bound over on, the judge found that there was sufficient evidence to try them on a charge of damage to cemetery property, which is a Class I felony.
How much is the penalty for that?
3.5 years.
Okay.
And a charge of attempted criminal damage to property.
And what's the penalty for that?
The penalties for that charge depend upon the value of the property involved. It could be either an A misdemeanor or an I felony. So it could be up to a maximum of 3.5 years. Thank you, Joe.
Can they be convicted on both in cumulative sentences?
I believe that's correct. I don't know of any prohibition on that.
So they're now facing 7 years, and if they convicted of third-degree sexual assault, they'd be facing 17 years.
Right.
Okay.
Yep.
Mr. Gansner, the Court of Appeals affirmed the dismissal of the case. Where did they go wrong?
We believe they went wrong in the same way that the circuit court went wrong in determining that the plain language of this statute does not mean what it says, and that instead what the statute means is that, as the circuit court viewed it and as the Court of Appeals viewed it, the statute only applies, and I want to point out to the court, as we attempted to point out in our brief, that there have been several formulations of what it is the defendants and then the Court of Appeals determined should be the meaning of the statute. What the Court of Appeals determined was the language, this section applies whether a victim is dead or alive at the time of the sexual contact or sexual intercourse, means this subsection is limited to criminalizing the act of sexually assaulting and causing the death of a person who is alive at the beginning of the course of events and dead at the conclusion, regardless of when the victim's death occurs in that series of events. That's a quote from the Court of Appeals decision as to what subsection 7 means. Our view is that the Court of Appeals went off the tracks in determining that that meaning should be ascribed to a statute that contains no such words.
What did they mean by course of events?
The basis of the Court of Appeals ruling, as the basis of the Circuit Court's ruling, was that this statute should be limited to what the defendants argued was the purpose of subsection 7. Their view was that subsection 7 was adopted and added to the sexual assault law in 1986 in principal response to a Court of Appeals decision at 128 Wisconsin 2nd, State versus Holt, in which the Wisconsin Court of Appeals, this court denied review in Holt, the Wisconsin Court of Appeals ruled that the then existing 940.225, which did not contain subsection 7, did not apply to a, could not apply and did not criminalize the sexual assault of a dead person. That the only victim of a sexual assault, contact or intercourse as prohibited by 940.225, could be a live person. It did not apply to a dead person. It was not necessary for the court to so hold in the Holt case. They simply recognized, I believe, and accepted the agreement of the parties, the state and the defendant in the Holt case, that the law as it then existed did not cover the sexual assault of a dead person. And the court went on to say...
Let me come right to the point. In terms of course of events and perhaps unfairly, you can characterize your opponent's argument on this. Let us take Jeffrey Dahmer. Jeffrey Dahmer drugged certain people, killed certain people, and purportedly had sexual relations with them immediately afterwards. Would that be covered, in their view, by this statute?
Mr. Olson and Ms. Edwards can correct me if I'm wrong, but I believe it is their position that if Jeffrey Dahmer killed an individual and then immediately thereafter engaged in some sexual contact that would be deemed otherwise a sexual assault of the individual, that that would be covered. The only hesitation I have in saying this, and I think they will need to address that, is that in their argument they appear to focus on a requirement that the killing and the sexual assault must be part of a continuous course of conduct, which again is a bit of terminology that is not present in the language of subsection 7, but I believe that's their position.
Let me ask this follow-up question. Let us suppose we had a Jeffrey Dahmer-type person who killed somebody, had sexual relations with that person or sexual contact with that person immediately following the death, and then kept the body around for a while. And maybe the next, let's say this was one night, and maybe the next afternoon had sexual contact again. What does their theory say?
I don't know. And for the state, that raises a significant question as to the accuracy or the reliability of their interpretation of the statute, because the question is begged but not answered by the defendant's arguments. And it is one of the problems that we have with their interpretation of the statute. In fact, the possibility, and again, they can speak to what their view of the statute is, whether it would apply to an act of sexual contact that occurred sometime after the killing of the individual by the person who did the killing, raises a question, I think, of the rationality of a judgment that says it's a crime, in their view, to kill an individual and immediately thereafter have sexual contact with the dead body. But it is not a crime to kill a person, wait a while, and then have sexual contact with the body of the dead victim. And if it is their view that some period of delay between the killing and the contact would still render the sexual contact a crime, under 942.25, they've made no offer or suggestion as to what that time period would be. That's one of the problems we have with their interpretation of the statute. I don't think they've offered an answer for it, and I am not aware of any answer to that question that can be provided by either the text of this statute or the legislative history upon which their argument is largely based.
Is the statute ambiguous?
I think our view, first of all, is that the plain language of 940.225 is so clear that the statute is really subject to only one reasonable interpretation and is not ambiguous. We recognize that's been our argument throughout. We recognize, however, that this court might reach a different conclusion. In our view, as a result, if the statute is determined to be ambiguous, and our principal argument is that it's not because the language is so clear, that the interpretation given by the defendants to the statute is not a reasonable interpretation. And if it is so, as in our view, not reasonable, so unreasonable, We believe that that is additional reason why the statute is not ambiguous. Okay. But if this court exercises any doubt about the ambiguity and we reach the legislative history of the Act, it's our position, finally, that the legislative history of the Act does not support their interpretation, and that the two competing interpretations of the statute, of them, the state's is the more reasonable and should be adopted.
The Chief Justice asked you whether subsection 7 applied to the entire statute 940.225.
Yes.
And I think your answer was yes.
Yes, insofar as we can tell and as we've been able to work through the statute, it appears to us that it can and should, and that it was intended to do so.
Well, does that mean that there are various degrees of sexual assault with a dead body?
Yes, as there are.
Does that make any sense?
If the facts of a particular case would support the application of the various degrees, the 4 degrees of sexual assault that are specified within the statute, then yes. But, of course, the fact that a particular factual circumstance may not necessarily satisfy each of the various degrees of sexual assault does not mean, as I think the defendant suggests, that there's some hole in the state's argument because not every subsection could necessarily apply. We think that's a facetious argument. And let me offer one simple example of it. Subsection 940.225.1a, first-degree sexual assault, the first example of the type of sexual contact that is deemed to be worthy of punishment as a Class B felony, provides that it is a crime for an individual to have sexual contact or sexual intercourse with another person without consent of that person and cause pregnancy. Well, clearly, if a male were sexually assaulted, pregnancy could not and would not be caused.
Well,
that does not mean that subsection 1A, if it applies to male victims, is somehow unreasonable, or it's an unreasonable interpretation of the statute
Counsel,
to say that it applies to male.
The statute says either causes pregnancy or great bodily harm.
Or great bodily harm, that's right.
So you can cause great bodily harm to a male, you can cause great bodily harm to a female.
No question.
Or cause pregnancy, but it doesn't have to be both.
It does not have to be both, no.
Isn't your problem consent?
Excuse me?
Isn't your problem consent?
Well, the defendants believe it is, and I don't think it is.
Look at subsection 4. Yeah. Consent means words or overt actions by a person who is competent to give informed consent, indicating a freely given agreement to have sexual intercourse or sexual contact.
Right.
Now, the decedent was not competent. I mean, we don't usually use words like competent to describe a deceased person.
Right.
So you have a little problem. But they could not give consent, right?
Exactly. Okay. I don't think there's any question.
Right.
A dead person could not consent.
Right. The following persons are presumed incapable of consent, but it can be rebutted. And who is that? Person suffering from mental illness or defect, person who is unconscious or for any other reason physically unable to communicate, unwillingness to act.
Subsection C. It's our view. And
well,
as we,
your view that is the person who is dead is unconscious.
A person who is dead is physically unable to communicate, unwillingness.
Well, physically unable to do it. So that's how you get around the consent issue.
Right, right. And I must say, this is not a pleasant task. As the state has attempted in dealing with the application of this statute to these facts, has attempted to think through the various possible questions about application of this statute to other acts, it has been difficult to do so. Frankly, in more than 2 decades of dealing with criminal law, I had not imagined until this case came along the factual circumstances of this case.
But and the legislature probably didn't think of it either, did it?
It may well not have contemplated this, but the question is whether or not they used language that was broad enough to incorporate a range of conduct. And
they thought about death for some reason. I mean, under 7, they knew that a victim could be dead and still be the victim of sexual assault, so that it's not like they didn't think of it at all.
No.
So your response has to be the legislature intended it to cover this very fact situation.
Or that the legislation was written broadly enough to incorporate a range of conduct, even if all of the particulars of the various degrees or types of what Justice Bradley has described as horrendous conduct could not have been fully predicted or contemplated by the legislature.
Well, this conduct is horrendous. Has the legislature repaired what might have been a hole, depending on what this court decides?
Have they? They have not, as the defendants have advised the court in their briefing. A bill was introduced in the state Senate in the aftermath of the Court of Appeals, in the wake of the Court of Appeals decision in this case. That bill has been pending in the legislature since last summer. The only activity that has occurred on the case is a public hearing in the month of January. Like hundreds of other bills that are proposed during a legislative session, there is a finite probability, unknown at this point, of whether the bill will advance or face simply a demise within the legislative process. The legislature has not seen fit to act. And it would be a little presumptuous on my part to suggest why the bill has not advanced. But since the defendants have raised the question by suggesting, well, here the legislature must be thinking that the current statute doesn't apply to the facts alleged in this case, we better propose something, I would suggest that one possible explanation for why the bill has not advanced is that there is some doubt in the minds of those who proposed the legislation whether it is necessary. That is to say, if this court agrees with the state's position and reverses the Court of Appeals decision, it may very well be that the legislation that has been proposed would serve no purpose.
Mr. Gaston, let me ask you
this. The problem would be solved by a decision of this court.
Let me ask you this. In Holt, both parties, including the state, argued that person did not include someone who was dead. I didn't go back to pull the briefs to see upon which that analysis was based, but it appears that the court seemed to accept that in rendering its decision.
Right. The court simply said in the decision at 128 Wisconsin 2nd that the defendant had argued that the statute did not apply except to a live person, and the state agrees
right. That
sexual intercourse with a dead body does not violate Wisconsin's sexual assault law. The court offered no opinion on the subject, but proceeded to decide this case as if the parties were correct.
Exactly. And so my question is this. I'm looking at the definition of, looking at the statutory section 940.225. Throughout the statute, it refers to person. In a couple of places, I believe it refers to the term individual when talking about the person who might be affected by this. Now, if we accept the approach that the word person means someone who was born alive, or someone who was living at the time, we then get to sub 7 that defines, that says that that section applies whether a victim, not person, victim, is dead or alive. What significance should this court give to the term victim as how it applies under sub 7 as opposed to the term person that has at least previously been acknowledged not to apply to someone who was alive? Do you understand the gist of my question?
Mm-hmm. I do understand your question. I'm not sure exactly how to describe what the legislature's view of the difference between person and victim was in this circumstance. It may have been nothing more than a concern that a different word of some type needed to be applied to the case of a victim of a sexual assault who was dead at the time, which is clearly what subsection 7 at its very least, was specifically providing that the victim, I mean, under the defendant's argument, if there should be no doubt here that the defendants are acknowledging that the sexual assault law can apply to a dead sexual assault victim. Their view is, however, that can happen only under a set of limited circumstances where, although they've expressed it in different ways, there was some continuing conduct in which the same defendant both killed and sexually assaulted the victim. I don't know, I don't attach, Justice Butler, any dispositive significance or dispositive interpretive significance to the use of person in most cases and to the use of victim in subsection 7 as opposed to the rest of the statute. I think it would be, if I can, particularly helpful for this court to focus on the legislative history emphasis that the defendants rely upon, the legislative history to which they give so much emphasis. We spent a good deal of time arguing in our brief that this court need not reach the extrinsic aids of analyzing the legislative history in this case, but we have argued, as I stated summarily earlier, that in the event that this court believes that resort to the legislative history is appropriate, the legislative history does not support the defendant's interpretation of the statute and more reasonably supports the state's. And I'd like to take a moment, if I can.
Oh, you have 5 minutes in rebuttal, counsel.
Oh, I'm sorry.
That's all right.
That is what that red light means, isn't it?
You've been here before.
Time flies when you're answering questions from this court.
Right. Thank you, Mr. Gansner. Ms. Edwards, you represent Nicholas Owen Grunke, and I gather that Alexander Caleb Grunke is relying on your briefs.
Thank you, Chief Justice, and may it please the court. The factual portion of, by the way, my name is Suzanne Edwards, and I do represent Nicholas Owen Grunke, and the factual basis or was taken, I didn't write my own factual basis, I used part of what the state did, and instead of rewriting it over and over again. As far as the documents attached. The question, there's sort of a three-part question. Number one, is the statute ambiguous? I mean, subsection 7. If it is ambiguous, what is the legislative intent behind the enactment of that subsection? And if we can determine that from extrinsic sources, does that subsection extend to the fact scenario which we have in this case? The Court of Appeals did find that the statute was, that subsection was ambiguous in that reasonably educated people could come up with two different interpretations of what it meant. And they did look to the legislative intent and saw that the subsection was enacted after the Holt case for the purpose of ensuring that prosecutions, sexual assault prosecutions, could be, you could get a conviction where you couldn't determine the time of death in a murder, rape type scenario. Because the problem in Holt was that the defendant argued, well, if you can't determine the time of death, then you can't, the jury cannot determine whether the victim was alive or was deceased at the time of the sexual assault. So the legislature added subsection 7 to help the state get convictions for sexual assault if the time of death could not be determined.
Could I ask this question? Let's say we have a defendant who has murdered a person, and that defendant gives a statement to the police. And in the statement, the defendant concedes that he killed the victim, and that after he killed the victim, he had sexual contact or sexual relations with the victim. Does the statute, in your view, apply to a charge of sexual assault of the victim under 940.225.3, I believe it is?
Yes, Justice Prosser, it would. In fact, referring to your earlier scenario about what if someone were to kill someone and have sexual relations with them and then another day later, I do believe that a charge could be brought for the second sexual assault because it was the defendant who put the person into victim status. And the statute says death of victim. The subsection is labeled death of victim. And this, so this refers to their status as a victim, not merely as a dead body. And it doesn't cover the type of scenario where you have a buried corpse that's disinterred.
So you have to have a victim of the sexual assault? Is that your point under 7?
They have to be... I guess I was thinking of it in terms of...
You have to be the victim of the death.
Be a victim of kidnapping, as in Holt. He was charged with kidnapping.
Okay.
Once you use some sort of force and take the, if you kidnap them, now they're in victim status. And if a sexual assault occurs any time during that period and time of death can't be determined, you could still prosecute for sexual assault. But, the question is, do we expand the meaning of
Let me just ask this. If a defendant kills a person and then has sexual relations or sexual contact with that person immediately afterwards, there's no question in your mind that's going to count under the statute. Is that right?
No, the way I read the statute is to cover situations where the time of death cannot be determined, and that's an element that the state would have to prove in order to have a conviction for sexual assault. The way the statute was written prior, the state would have to prove that the victim was alive during the sexual assault. And so you could never get a sexual assault conviction in a rape murder type scenario unless you had a definite time of death, which
is that the old law or the new law?
That was the old law, and this section was put in to relieve the state from having to prove time of death in order to sustain a conviction.
That's what I thought I understood. But in my hypothetical, the defendant confesses to the fact that he A, kills the person, and then, second, commits a sexual assault after the person is dead. But I thought you said that he could be prosecuted for sexual assault.
Well, if that's a scenario where they say, I killed the person at noon and then had sexual relations with them at, midnight, current Wisconsin law does not prohibit that act of having sex with a dead body. However...
So now wait a second. Are you saying that the moment the person confesses that he had sexual relations after the person was dead, he immunizes himself from the charge, a sexual assault charge? Is that what you're saying?
Well, I would hope that... That's not the case. A confession to a sequence of events is not necessarily what the state is going to rely on as proof of, the time of death at trial. But, the situation in the instant case is that this is a buried body. This is a body who has not been victimized by the defendants, has not put her in that situation. Okay, so your scenario is a little difficult for me to answer, you know, definitively, because I've been so focused on the situation that we have here, where you have a buried corpse which is potentially disinterred. And I do not believe that the statute, that subsection, was enacted to cover that sort of scenario.
Counselor, if a person was working in a hospital and it's 2 o'clock in the morning and he comes into Jane's room and she's stone cold dead, and he says, oh, great opportunity, and has sexual intercourse with her, can he be prosecuted under this statute?
No.
Can't be prosecuted under any other statute either, right?
He cannot be prosecuted under the sexual assault statute unless he caused her death. If she's just deceased from, you know, he didn't put her, victimize her. Now, that's just the current state of Wisconsin law. Not every state has a statute which prohibits necrophilia. Some states, California recently enacted one, and so I think because it's so rare that, you know, not every state feels that they need to do it, but Iowa has a statute that says that, and those penalties and those situations are pretty high, too. So,
thank you. It seems to me that you're reading subsection as follows. The victim of an offense by the defendant, whether a victim by of an offense by the defendant is dead or alive at the time of the sexual assault by the defendant, the defendant is guilty of sexual assault. In other words, the way I hear you, the defendant has to have caused the death of the victim in one way or another. And then, either before or after the act of death, committed a sexual assault.
Yes, I see my lights on.
Victim. Is that what your position is?
Yes, that the defendant had to have put the person in some sort of victimhood status.
And it has to be dead.
Well,
if it's alive, we don't have all these problems here, right? Victim is alive at the time of the sexual assault. We don't have any problems under the
exactly.
statute.
Exactly. But okay. The difference is, do we have someone who is a victim of crime or an assault or something, or are we just happening upon a dead body, as in Justice Rogensack, you know, explains? There's two different things. So, you know, the question is, can a dead, buried corpse be victimized? Because they have to have the status of a victim in order for that statute to apply. It says whether the victim is dead or alive. Well, can we victimize the buried?
Thank you, Ms. Edwards. Mr. Olson?
May it please the court, I'm Jeffrey Olson. I'm representing Dustin Radke. I want to pick up on the Chief Justice's question about consent being the problem with the state's reading in this case. The structure and the text and the purpose of the sexual assault statute, I think, shows that its primary purpose is to protect the living. And by living, I mean somebody who can feel or suffer harm or consequences from a sexual assault and who has some minimum capacity to act. Maybe not necessarily to engage in sexual activity, because the statute clearly provides that for some categories of persons, consent is not an issue. They cannot consent. But that still there's a basic requirement of having a living being as a victim of a sexual assault. And it was that design and that basic premise of the whole statute that made sub 7 necessary to begin with. Because as the state conceded in the Court of Appeals in Holt, as the Court of Appeals accepted, the statute before sub 7 was enacted just did not apply to a corpse, regardless of the circumstances.
Well, Mr. Olson, let me ask you this. I understand your argument in terms of how you're looking at the creation of sub 7, but why isn't it reasonable to take sub 7 and the wording that's there that says this section applies whether a victim is dead or alive, as an indication that the term person or individual, because I think it is individual in a couple of places in the statute, that term has been broadened to include more than a live individual? Why is it unreasonable to read that section in that fashion?
The statute, subsection 7, clearly expands the scope of prosecutions under 940, 227, or 225. That's clear. But it doesn't reinterpret all the uses of the word person in the statute. It doesn't suddenly say person includes dead people or corpses. And as you pointed out in your question to Mr. Gansner, most of the references in the statute are to person. There are a couple of other instances where victim does appear in the statute, subsection 1B, subsection 2B, where they clearly imply that this is somebody who is having, you know, been the victim of other overt acts leading to the sexual assault. And that supports your suggestion that the word victim in sub 7 means somebody who has already been subject to some sort of act to overcome their will or to subject them to a non-consensual sexual activity.
I don't know if that's what it means, and that's why I'm asking the question.
I think that's the way to read it reasonably within the text of the rest of the statute. With all the other words in the statute, which everybody agrees, everyone on both sides of the podium here agree, that this section, that those first two words in sub 7 includes everything else in 942.25. And it includes consent, and which is to go back to my point about why consent is the problem with the state's reading. If the without consent element can be proven in the way the state suggests in its reply brief by reference to subsection 4, paragraph C, the inability to communicate, then we don't need sub 7 at all. The concession of the state in Holt was unnecessary. The Court of Appeals didn't need to find that the statute didn't apply to dead persons because that language, under sub 4, that definition of consent has remained virtually unchanged since this statute was enacted, except to add new categories of people who cannot consent.
Well, here's the question that I have, because I understand your argument, but in the Holt situation, as I understand it, part of the reason for the Holt decision was because you could not tell whether the individual was dead or alive. And I think the way the Court of Appeals handled it in this decision was that, well, that's a question that we'll leave up to the jury. And that's how they kind of approached it. And that the argument is that this particular section was created to deal with that, leaving that question up to the jury. But the way this is worded, don't you have the same problem in a Holt situation that you would have in a non-Holt situation? If the person is already dead, they still can't consent.
But they've been victimized by other acts against their consent. If they've been killed by the defendant in the course of trying to commit the sexual assault, of trying to compel submission to intercourse or contact, That is the, that's where the lack of consent enters in. And as I pointed out in my brief, this is exactly the road other states have gone down in addressing this issue. Others, I'm not aware of any other state that has a statute like this, but I put in my brief, in the very last section, cases from a couple of states that have created basically a judge-made rule that that basically says that, that says if there's this continuous course of events, which is frankly where I stole that language from, if there's during this continuous course of events, the that began without the consent of the victim, the initial, you know, physical application of physical force, the attempt to force sexual contact or intercourse, that leads to the death, but you can't be sure when the intercourse occurred. It doesn't matter that the victim died.
Let me ask the question differently, because maybe I'm not conveying what's bothering me. I think the argument that you're making assumes that we have a sexual assault that is taking place, and during the course of the assault, an individual is killed. They may be killed before the assault occurs. They may be killed after the assault occurs. You can't really tell that this section was designed to deal with it. But I'm envisioning a situation where you have a burglary that takes place.
I'm sorry, Abe.
Where you have a burglary that takes place, and a person breaks into a home, and they see an individual that's in the home, and they kill the individual, and then they have sex with the body. Now, as I understand your argument, it's the same course of conduct, the same interaction, the same fact pattern situation, yet this statute would govern that as well as govern a sexual assault. And so that's why I'm having problems dicing it in that fashion, because it seems that your argument embraces more than a sexual assault. It just embraces the concept of conduct. A continuous course of conduct, where I think you're trying to argue that it should be just a sexual assault, and which goes back to my original question, was the legislature trying to simplify things by just redefining person?
For purposes of 940.
For purposes of 940.225.
I don't think it was meant to redefine person. In the sense the state is suggesting, to include all corpses under all circumstances. And I think that's because of the language of sub 7 itself. It says that this section applies whether the victim is dead or alive at the time of the sexual assault or the sexual contact or sexual intercourse. If this was meant to create, to extend the concept or the definition of person to all corpses under all circumstances, they should have stopped at the words dead or alive. It should say dead or alive, period. Doesn't matter whether they were dead or alive at the time at the course of conduct began or the attempted sexual intercourse or contact began. All that matters is, all that we want to say in this statute is, corpses are covered, period. The fact that there's a reference to timing in there takes this right back to Holt and shows that that was the specific scenario that this statute was trying to deal with. They wouldn't need a reference to time of the sexual activity if they had contemplated this to be a general necrophilia statute, because that is plainly the object of the sexual activity in that case is already dead at the beginning. Here, a statute that is already designed and presumes a living person, the victim will always be alive at the beginning of the course of conduct. But not necessarily under the Holt scenario at the end, and it's that the statute is meant to deal with.
Didn't subsection 7 introduce the word victim?
No, it didn't, Justice Prosser. As I was explaining to Justice Butler, there are a couple of other instances of the word victim in the statute. At least in the current version, I should double-check my the version that was in existence when Holt was adopted. And there, too, in the 1983-84 version of the statute, subsection 1, paragraph B, does refer to victim. It's referring to using a weapon or an article fashioned to make the victim reasonably believe it's a weapon. And then I believe also subsection 2, paragraph B, it refers to causing particular kinds of impairment or loss to the victim. I think those are the only other occurrences of the word victim in the entire statute.
But wouldn't it make sense to have language following the word victim that explained what the victimization was?
No, because this is the sexual assault statute. This section applies whether a victim is dead or alive. A victim of any one of these assaults, any one of the four categories.
Well, now, would you say that the Legislative Reference Bureau has never drafted language that might have been more than absolutely necessary?
Never. certainly it can happen. But I think that we don't need to speculate about whether there was some sort of drafting mistake here when we have the drafting file, which really parallels the problem caused by Holt. And while I'm talking about Holt, I do want to say one thing about Holt and its relationship to sub 7. I believe the state at one point in its brief, on page 28 of its brief, and she talks about how sub 7 is basically a response to the statement in Holt that the sexual assault statute doesn't apply to dead bodies. And in fact, the timing is a little different. I mean, the bill that became sub 7 was actually drafted and introduced before the Holt decision was issued. According to the drafting file, which is in my in the appendix to my brief, it was actually introduced in May of 1985. And Holt itself wasn't decided until December of 85. So the language in sub 7, it was drafted without knowing what the Court of Appeals was going to say. And just like the bill that's pending now that I included in my appendix was drafted without knowing what the Court of Appeals did in this case, because the bill was actually introduced the day before the Court of Appeals opinion was issued.
Doesn't that cut into your argument?
No, it doesn't. It supports it because it really shows that what the drafting was meant to address was the factual scenario, not a particular court of appeals holding, but this argument that they knew was going on and that had gone on in these cases because they were clearly being litigated at the time, that it appears, and the defendants are arguing these cases, that if the victim has died, they cannot be convicted of sexual assault.
Well, Mr. I found that your Legislative Reference Bureau materials were quite interesting. If you look at that drafting request sheet, which you just cited for the date when the request was made, subject, that's page 105. Subject is sexual assault, dead victims.
Yes.
It seems to me that goes with the state. And the preceding 103, topic, sexual assault on dead victim.
That's the... That actually wasn't written by the drafter. That was written by the enroller.
Okay. So I infer from what you have just said that you think that the note here were written by Bruce Boyskull, the drafter. Is that right?
Right. I think that the point, the part of the drafting file that is most salient to this issue are the instructions that the drafter got from the requester, which is what I cite multiple times in my brief, and that's on page 107.
Okay. But that
that describes in more particularity the problem that the legislator wanted this bill to address.
But surely there have been drafting requests with a particular fact situation in mind. Language is produced, and it applies to fact situations beyond what was originally intended. I'm thinking of one that has bedeviled this court for years, the recreational immunity statute. You don't think the drafting request spelled out every possible fact situation that could come up under that statute?
That's certainly true, and the legislature is not omniscient. Nobody is. But I think there are reasons to hew to a more limited reading. One, again, is the language which I just cited about how it is focused on the timing of the acts, of the death and the sexual assault. And again, the language wouldn't have needed to refer to timing at all if they had broader purposes in mind.
Rosa, I have a question for you. If the death was to be a consequence, kind of a unexpected consequence, perhaps, of the sexual assault, which is what I hear you saying.
That's essentially what it was in Holt.
Why wouldn't the legislature use essentially the same language they do in 948.21, for example, where they talk about the penalty being a Class A misdemeanor or, if death is a consequence, a Class D felony? They pretty clearly specify there the difference between the crime being committed to someone who's alive and the crime being committed to someone who dies as a consequence of the criminal act. And it strikes me that right around the same time these laws are being done, 1987 was when 942.25 was at least at some point fine-tuned. And, you know, they pretty clearly say in sub 7, section applies whether the victim is dead or alive at the time of the sexual contact or sexual intercourse. If they meant to have it be regardless of whether the death is a consequence of the sexual assault or contact, could have said that. And it'd be pretty clear for all of us if they didn't intend it to mean sexual assault of a corpse, sexual assault of a live person. Both are wrong under the statute.
But by referring to this section, it's talking about only prosecutions under that section and enabling a prosecutor to charge and take to jury and get a conviction in a case where the time of death is not clear. And it's not a question of whether the person can be prosecuted separately for the death. I mean, Holt was prosecuted for that as well. It's a question of whether where there is evidence of sexual assault, that can also be prosecuted, even though it's unclear that when the intercourse and contact occurred with respect to the death.
But then they could have said, this section applies whether a victim is alive or dies as a consequence of the sexual assault or contact.
Yes.
And that would
But I think that replicates the timing language. At the time of the sexual intercourse or sexual contact. And that's what it already says, time.
But it doesn't say that, and that's the difference. It just says it applies whether they're alive or dead. It doesn't say anything as a consequence of the sexual assault. And so that's why I think there's a problem potentially with your argument there. Or if timing was an issue, they'd do it much like they do the repeated sexual assault of a child statute, where they talk about there being a series of events within a time frame. You know, the legislature's dealt with things like that. That's why I'm struggling to know how the words can't mean what they say.
It, if I could just respond briefly.
You may, counsel.
It does say at the time, you know, let me read the statute verbatim so I don't make a mistake. This section applies whether a victim is dead or alive at the time.
Right.
And again, that brings it back to the focus of the acts of sexual activity and not necessarily whether the death is a consequence of the sexual activity or not. And
is it your position that the person who commits the sexual assault under 7 has to also be the person who kills to make 7 work?
As in the actual principle of, no, it could be party to a crime liability.
Okay. Party to crime, I don't care if it's principal or an aider or a better or a conspirator, but that the killer, somebody who can be charged with killing, is also the person who committed the sexual assault.
I think so, because I think that...
Okay, so your answer to Justice Prosser's question of whether the assault and the death are simultaneous, or the assault precedes the death, or the assault is a week after the death and the body is still in the house, your answer is all of those would be covered by 7. Is that right?
I'll have to be honest with you. The week later is a little bit less clear to me. And okay. I mean, I think that the paradigmatic situation is where this is all one continuous course of conduct. And that's those are the words I used in the brief. Okay. And I think at some point, as in any other crime and in any other case where we have trouble figuring out everything that happened and in what order, at some point that continuity could be broken. Mm-hmm. And those are going to be fact questions for a jury. Mm-hmm.
So if it's a week later, the jury might very well find that doesn't come under the statute.
Exactly. Yes.
Or maybe it won't. The charge will be dismissed.
Or maybe it won't even be brought, and particularly if the Senate bill that's pending passes.
Thank you, Mr. Olson. Mr. Ganston?
The defendants contend that it is not a crime to sexually assault a person you did not kill. That's a grisly distinction that does not appear in the statute, nor does it appear in the history of this act. The 20 words of subsection 7, it is the state's position, have the meaning that the ordinary usage of the English language would give to them. It is our position that the legislature said what it meant and meant what it said when it said the sexual assault law, which clearly applies to a victim of a sexual assault who is alive, also applies to the victim of a sexual assault who is dead at the time of the sexual assault.
I need help with this because earlier you said there are various degrees of sexual assault in a corpse.
Yep.
And we started focusing on 1A, that is 940.225.1A, which is the first degree. And you used the example of, well, maybe it wouldn't apply if the male was the victim because the male can't be pregnant, and then the questions focused on the or nature of it or great bodily harm to that
mm-hmm.
person. But this is, the whole question is here, and as you indicated, the varying degrees of sexual assault with a corpse. So I want to read first degree. Has sexual contact or sexual intercourse with a corpse without the consent of the corpse and causes pregnancy or great bodily harm to the corpse. To me, you know, you talk about plain language. When you put in corpse there, as we're saying, that seems a bit absurd to mean, there's an argument about whether or not the corpse can give consent, but I'm not even focusing on that. I mean, the end of the phrase, causes pregnancy or great bodily harm to the corpse, makes no sense to me. Likewise, with second degree, and that's set forth in 2A, and that would be that whoever does any of the following is guilty. That is, has sexual contact or sexual intercourse with a corpse without consent of the corpse by use or threat of force or violence on the corpse. That doesn't make sense to me. Can you help me find sense in applying, having corpse be a person in first and second degree?
Mm-hmm.
Help.
The point I attempted to make before, perhaps unsuccessfully, was that the fact that every subsection or every section of the subsection of the statute cannot factually be satisfied with different victims does not mean that the statute reading victim in subsection 7 to mean a corpse is absurd, or that it is absurd to apply 94225 to circumstances where the victim is a corpse. It simply means, it doesn't mean it's absurd, because it is not absurd for a statute not to apply to factual circumstances that are not enumerated in the statute.
Let me ask more pointedly.
It simply means the statute doesn't apply, not that it's absurd.
And there being first-degree sexual assault of a corpse.
Apparently not. In the same way that you could not have...
If I may.
You could not have a first-degree sexual assault of a male causing pregnancy. The statute, it's not absurd to say that a victim can be a male.
It could apply to the male if it was great bodily harm.
It could be.
Can first-degree sexual assault apply to a corpse, ever?
Yes.
Excuse me?
Can first-degree sexual assault apply to a corpse, ever?
Certainly not under the and causes pregnancy provision.
How about
and under the great bodily harm provision, I suspect the answer is not, but that would require some analysis of the meaning of great bodily harm that this court has spent in numerous cases an awful lot of time on.
Mr. Ganster.
I suspect the answer is probably not.
Mr. Ganster,
well,
the test for Justice Bradley's question is, you can substitute the words living person in this statute for person. And it won't matter if it's male or female.
Sure.
You can substitute living person.
Sure.
And the statute makes sense.
Right.
In any particular fact situation, one or more elements might not be there. And that's what your continuous response to Justice Bradley is.
Mm-hmm.
But you can substitute living person and the statute makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
You cannot substitute corpse and have this statute make sense. And what has happened in this statute is what happens often in drafting. There is an idea for an amendment, and what is done is stick on another subsection. And the drafters, neither the drafters nor the legislature, goes back and sees how that fits into any subsection. And that's what's happened here, because you can't fit in corpse into the statute.
Your Honor,
and if you were going to do it carefully, I suggest you would put it under consent and define consent to mean that it's presumed that somebody who is dead cannot consent.
Oh, I don't doubt that for a moment. That was one of several choices that I think the legislature had when it apparently decided that in the aftermath or in anticipation of the Court of Appeals' decision or in the aftermath of both the Holt trial in Kenosha County and the Coppett, K-O-P-U-T, trial in Milwaukee County, that there were circumstances in which juries apparently might acquit a person of a brutal sexual assault because they had doubt as to whether the victim was alive at the time of the commission of the crime.
Yeah,
there's no question. I think that's what the legislature was dealing with. But I don't think we have, I certainly don't have, I'm not sure that this court has, the authority to say, well, the legislature should have done this, but they did do this, and what they did do probably can only mean what they should have done. I don't think it's appropriate for this court to write words into a statute right. that the legislature did not put. I mean, that's what the division and the separation of right. powers, I think, requires and means. As this court has said, there are occasions in which this court's interpretation of a statute, you need to stay the pen.
Right.
The legislature needs to write, and this court needs to interpret.
And, Mr. Gassner, that's what I want to ask you about. None of the three of you have discussed the import of Section 944.21.
What's that number, Justin?
944.21. And specifically paren 2, paren D and E. And D is the definition of obscene performance, which is applied in sub 3. It includes sexual conduct. E is sexual conduct. Means the commission of any of the following: sexual intercourse, sodomy, bestiality, necrophilia, and so on and so forth. And I only bring this up because at least in one area, the legislature is dealing with the concept of necrophilia and dealing with it very specifically and very directly. And it doesn't seem to be as specific or direct under 940.225. And I don't know if you've had an opportunity to think about it or if you've seen the statute before, but it raises questions that it clearly connotes an understanding that the legislature has of what necrophilia is and how it can be applied, and they didn't use that term in 940.225.
I understand.
How do you take that?
I haven't noted the statute before. I haven't thought about it. I'd welcome the opportunity to submit something in a short period of time to the court on the subject if you believe that it's appropriate, because I cannot give you an answer having not even thought about the matter up until this point. Other than I know, I think Justice Prosser's question to Mr. Olson a while ago indicated that there are times when the legislature does a more complete and thoughtful job of thinking out possible changes in the statutes than they do on other occasions. The statute you're referring to may have been one in which greater thought was given.
Mr. Gansner, if you were sitting in your office and you got a report...
If this question is as difficult as it is, I'm going to wish I was in my office. Sorry, Judge.
You're sitting in your office, and you get a report from Plainfield, Wisconsin, that a local person has been digging up graves and taking corpses and then carving up those corpses, including the intimate parts of those corpses, and making cups out of breasts, for example. Is that something that might...
If I were transported back in time to the Ed Gein era?
That's right. Is that something that might be prosecuted under 942.251, great bodily harm? Sexual contact? Great bodily harm?
Well, certainly great harm is being caused to a body of a dead victim. When I suggested before that it was conceivable that the great bodily harm provision of subsection 1A might apply, depending upon the definition and application of the great bodily harm statute, that is not specifically what I had in mind. But
it
occurs to me that that's at least an available avenue.
Don't you have a statute that governs mutilating a corpse?
There is such a statute, and there might be an argument that the more specific statute ought to apply, but not necessarily to the exclusion of the broader statute.
You know, in these cases where there's a killing, you've got the killing, you've got the maximum penalty already. You don't really have to even resort to it. I mean, you may want to pile it on, but you don't have to resort to sexual assault if you've got a killing.
No, not necessarily.
And under the Holt case, the penalties were different.
Yes.
For murder.
Holt was prior to the truth in sentencing, recodification,
right. Exactly.
Rejiggering of.
So rather than have a person eligible for parole in, 13 years, you might have to add charges. But what's the penalty now for murder?
What's the penalty?
What's the penalty now for murder?
Life imprisonment.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So you don't need to add, although there are several murders and several lives imprisonment, right?
Sure, sure. The,
so as I understand it, you think that the defendants are asking this section to be read as follows. This section applies when it is uncertain whether a victim is dead or alive at the time of the sexual conduct or sexual contact or sex intercourse.
Well, and I think the defendants are also saying that the same defendant must have both killed and sexually assaulted. And it appears to have been their position, and it was the Court of Appeals' position, that the death and the sexual assault have to be part of some closely, temporally related, continuous course of conduct. So we're adding about three separate subject matters to subsection 7.
But you don't abide my, you don't buy my simple addition of when it is uncertain whether a victim is dead or alive. That would cover Holt.
That would cover the Holt fact situation. And one point, when I had ran out of time before, and I'm up against a red light now too, and let me just say this. I think that Holt involved more than just a troublesome fact situation. I think Holt recognized, under the then-existing statute, that if you couldn't prove that the victim of a sexual assault was alive at the time of the sexual assault, it wasn't a crime of sexual assault. And thus, there might be cases in which, as you have just said, Justice Abrahamson, if it's uncertain when the time of the assault and the time of the death occurred, statute applies. That's a fact problem. That's a proof problem. But underlying what was happening in Holt was this. You had that proof problem because the substantive criminal law, as it then existed, required that the victim of a sexual assault be alive. It could not be a dead person. Both the proof problem and the substantive law problem were altered by the substantive law change and the addition of subsection 7 that said, from this point on, a sexual assault victim is not limited to a live person. A dead person can be a victim as well. That, by the that substantive law problem, also eliminated the Holt proof problem.
What was the substantive provision that made it a live person only?
That the law up until that time didn't provide for a dead person.
Okay, so
that's
that,
all, in which everybody recognized.
So the statute using the word person meant live. You think now this?
Oh, I think so. Yes, okay. Yes. I think that was everyone's understanding at the time, and that's what both parties and the Court of Appeals. In fact, Justice Prosser had indicated earlier. I think you made a comment, Justice Prosser, that you hadn't gone back to look at the briefs in Holt. I did recently, and I note that the defendant in the case, in arguing that the law at that time didn't cover a dead sexual assault victim, used these words. This is not to say that the Wisconsin legislature could not make such an act, sexual assault of a dead person, a criminal offense or even a sexual assault, but only that it hasn't yet done so. We submit that in adopting subsection 7, the legislature did just that.
Thank you, Mr. Gansner.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. Olson. Thank you, Ms. Edwards, for your argument in this sexual assault case or alleged sexual assault case. This concludes our argument in 2006, AP 2744, 45, and 46, State versus Alexander and Nicholas Krunke, and State versus Radke. The court will meet in the conference room at 3:30. Court will meet in oral argument later in March as scheduled.